History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that really should never go untold. They don't have to go untold if we're willing to take a little time, ask a few questions, and listen to what comes back our way. The idea here is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only do we end up educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. We lost a very special member of that generation last week in Las Vegas with the passing of ex-prisoner of war Dean Whitaker at the age of 97. We had the privilege of meeting him here on Hometown Heroes more than a decade ago, but he has been plenty busy in the years since, going to Washington, D.C. with Honor Flight Southern Nevada, learning how to paint, and even writing his memoirs. Dean's story is so special, so captivating, that we're going to make that the focal point of our hour together today. Let's start with how Dean experienced December 7th, 1941 in his native Southern California.
Well, I was working at a gas station Sunday morning. I didn't know anything about it, and somebody come driving in and said, "Did you hear the news?" I said, "No, is it Japan attacked Pearl Harbor?" And that was quite a thing to me because I was that age. Pretty soon I was going to join the service. I was a senior in high school, and the day continued, and people would drive in, and most people were kind of mad. As the day wore on, I heard more and more about what was going on, and it was quite thrilling.
Yeah, it seems like a very interesting place to get the news, and this is in Maywood, California, where you grew up. I imagine a lot of people that pulled in to get their tanks filled up maybe had just heard on their car radio or maybe even hadn't heard yet, and that was probably the only thing you guys talked about.
That's right. And, you know, gasoline was selling for 10 cents a gallon then. That was the cheapest, and it went clear up to 15, 18 cents a gallon, and that was when times were really good.
You know, I've talked to some other people who were in Southern California, I guess a little closer to the coast, like Long Beach area at that time, who, when they heard the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor, they were ready for the Japanese to attack L.A. that night, and they were out there looking for for enemy. Did you have any concern that California might come under attack? Was that something you thought of?
Oh, yes. We had air raid sirens. I think the balloons had come over, and we had heard the sirens going off in Long Beach, and we thought, my goodness, you know, what's going to happen here? Anything.
So you were ready to do something about it?
Yes, oh yeah, I was ready. And like I say, I was in high school, and I had three friends that we all wanted to join the Air Corps because they had these nice uniforms, and it sounded really good. So we went down to the old Pacific Electric building in L.A. and signed up. And luckily, I had taken a college course in high school, and I passed the exam for aviation cadet. The other fellas weren't that lucky, but they went in as aerial gunners. The four of us that went in, I was the only one that returned. Thank goodness I made it. But I'd go to a high school reunion and have no friends.
Well, that's the reality of the time that you lived in and the time that you served. So you wanted to be a pilot, I take it?
No, I didn't care what I made. I just wanted to be an aviation cadet. And I went through Santa Ana Air Base at classification, was classified for either one, pilot, navigator, or bombardier. And it just happened that they had the bombardier school was open and they're going to start at Victorville. And I thought, boy, at Victorville, you know, I can commute to home. And it was a short course. I think it was 18 weeks I'd be a second lieutenant. So I said, I'll take that. But they got to the W's and that class was full. So they shipped me off to Kingman, Arizona to gunnery school to wait for the next class. So I went through Kingman, Arizona, got my gunner's wings. The class was ready to start in Victorville, but they had changed that to bombardier navigator, and it took an additional 6 weeks, so I didn't make it. I was very fortunate there because the fellows that I was at Santa Ana with a classification got into B-26s and A-20s, which were known as flying coffins, and I had heard that a lot of those were those fellows were killed. So I was fortunate there that I did get to go to B-17s.
Do you remember the first time you went up in a B-17 and what kind of thrill that was for you?
Oh, yes, that was quite a thrill for an 18-year-old just graduated from high school at Kingman, Arizona. We got into B-17, I think there was about 10 of us, and we took off and we're flying, and I thought, boy, this is great. And we were flying at treetop level, and all of a sudden we were just flying along, and the ground just dropped out from underneath us. We went over the Grand Canyon, and what a sight, having the ground disappear, and here you're flying up in the air. It was wonderful. At the time, we were just starting class, and I thought, well, let's hurry up and get this class done. I did real good at the gunnery school because my dad had been quite a hunter, and we went hunting. I had my first 22 rifle from old Sears and Roebuck's there in Los Angeles when I was 14 years old, and I'd go hunting with that, and he had all kinds of guns, and my brother did. So when I went to gunnery school, they handed me a 45 caliber pistol to see if I could hit the target, and I amazed the instructor because I had shot in my dad's 32 automatic, and I just blasted that hole out of the center of that target. And he says, "You've been doing this before, haven't you?" I said, "Yeah, I've been shooting guns since I was 12. So anyway, at Kingman, I was the head of my class. I had my name put out on the bulletin board when I graduated. And I graduated and got a set of wings, which came in handy when I had visits to Los Angeles when I was in Kingman.
Came in handy how? Spell that out for us.
You know, I was an 18-year-old aviation cadet and had a nice uniform, and I had quite a few dates.
So those wings worked their magic for you. Pretty soon those wings would take you overseas with the 398th Bomb Group. Do you remember what it was like to head overseas thinking, well, pretty soon this is going to be real? No more practice, no more fooling around shooting at targets. This is the real deal.
Yes, England experienced a lot of bombing then, and luckily when we got there, they were all the buzz bombs, and not many bombers were flying over. But it was a thought that, you know, we are now in a danger zone, and we're going to be lucky to come out of this. And at the railroad station, when we were getting ready to go to our base, there was a lot of flyers there that had flown quite a few missions, and they had their medals on, and they really looked great. I said, boy, I sure hope I make this. So when we had arrived at the base, I thought, well, at least they have kind of a good facilities. We had tents that had wood sides on them, and we lived fairly comfortable there.
And by this time, had you started to form a bond with the guys that you'd be flying with? Was your crew able to stay together?
Yes, our crew stayed together. We had our training in Rapid City, South Dakota, where we met our crew and did some flying and bombing around there, practice bombing. So we got overseas. We were all very well acquainted with each other. We had one accident on takeoff where we hit a tractor when we're taking off. This is when we were learning how to fly with the group. We hit this tractor and crashed through a bunch of trees at the end of the runway. We all got out all right. The plane burned up, and I have pictures of that. But one of the tail gunners, the plane broke in half, and he was burnt pretty bad. He spent the rest of the war in the hospital. But this was over, and they put us back in an airplane the next day so we wouldn't get afraid to do that. And so we continued right away in our first mission.
Holy moly. I know that you lived through that, and you've described it a time or two since then, but I'm picturing myself in that situation, and that sounds pretty hair-raising to me. Where were you on the plane, and how did you experience that crash with the tractor?
I was up in the nose, and it was very scary, I'll tell you, having seen that tractor coming up. The fella operating the tractor, when he jumped off of it and run, I thought, man, we're in trouble. Actually, the nose didn't hit it, the wheel hit it, but when we hit the trees, the nose disintegrated and plexiglass was flying, and I had no trouble getting out of the plane because there was no nose. I just went right out with the navigator that was with me. We hit the dirt right away because the 50 caliber shells were going off and just buzzing all over the place. And, you know, they can do some damage when they're going off. So as soon as the fire crew got there from the base, they took us back to check us out. Nobody was hurt except the gunner.
That sounds like a close enough call to me. I mean, that could have been absolutely disastrous for you and for everybody there. And, you know, you hit on being in the nose, and maybe we should paint that picture for listeners. On a B-17, tell us about how many men you have on the crew and where your position was, because you end up with a pretty interesting view on everything.
Being up in the nose, you knew just exactly what was going on at all times. Now, when we were flying a mission, we'd get in clouds and all over the place, and it was a very pretty picture. And it was really nice when you're flying in a big group. The contrails from the planes, what the planes made, were quite eerie. It just lighted up the sky. The place I had as a bombardier was the front seat right by the, there was a turret there, and the bomb site was right between my legs. It wasn't very large, and the navigator sat behind me. He had a table, like a navigation table. And later on, when we were flying, they took our navigator to another crew when they learned that I had taken navigation training too. And they made me the navigator, and so I changed positions. I sat at the table, and I had a nose gunner up at the nose with me. He fired every shot, and just we didn't have much experience. All of our attacks were from the rear. The nose gunner wasn't very busy, but he was there to do if he had to.
Well, let's move on to your first mission, because I understand this was a fairly eventful mission, trial by fire, and I guess you got trial by fire before you even flew a mission with that crash with the tractor. But your first mission, you ended up with a Purple Heart after it. So tell me what happened on that first mission. This was right after D-Day?
Yes, it's right after D-Day when we were trying to make a breakout from the German lines. The Germans had a lot of firepower there, and I guess Eisenhower requested Air Force help, so we went in at a low altitude. We usually flew at about 28,000 feet. On this mission, I think it was at 5,000 or so feet, and every gun German had, it was shooting at us. I could see the flashes from the ground of them shooting at us, and we knew exactly when we flew over enemy lines when all this flashing started, and we were getting hit once in a while. I could smell it every time we got hit, the burning of the material against the aluminum around. And the plane next to us got hit real bad, and it exploded, and nobody got out of that. And it was quite a sight. It lasted me quite a while. But on the way back, just we went over the lines, we got hit again. The instrument panel in the plane and the nose got shot out. And the hydraulic line from the controls is red. And we had this red come all over us. And the navigator that was up with me thought he was shot. He saw, oh, my gosh, this red is coming out of my chest. Well, he rubbed it and found out that it was hydraulic fluid, so he felt great. But in the meantime, when the nose got shot out, I had a face full of plexiglass, and I could hardly see. And it was burning really bad. So we got back to the base, and they took me to the base hospital, cleaned my eyes out. And in the following few days, my eyes were swollen shut. And so I was off flying duty for 2 weeks. And as soon as they healed, I could see again, I was back. I think I missed just one mission because of that. But in those days, you know, it wasn't unusual for someone to get hit like that, and the commanding officer of our base was killed on the next mission, so he had no way to report anything. No Purple Hearts were given. I was visiting the VA here just a year or so ago, and the doctor asked me if I ever received, if I was ever damaged in any of the missions. I told him about my eyes. He said, "Did you get the Purple Heart?" I said, "No." He said, "You're going to get that for you." Well, he did, and 60 years later, I received the Purple Heart at the air base, in, at Nellis Air Base.
What did that mean to you, after all those years, to receive that medal and everything that comes with it?
Well, it was an honor for me because I had received the Air Medal with a couple Oak Leaf clusters and had a few other medals. But the Purple Heart, it is a special medal.
And another special one is the Prisoner of War Medal, an even more exclusive group that I know you're going to share with us about that. I don't want to dwell on this too long, but again, you described that because you lived through it, but the rest of us didn't. And I'm curious, when that happens, when the nose of your B-17, which you're sitting in, by the way, gets shot out, and the plexiglass ends up in your face, and you can't see, and you don't know if you're going to make it home on that mission, you don't know if you're ever going to see again, what goes through your mind? I mean, how did you get through that experience, and what maybe kept you focused in believing that you would be okay?
Well, it was a terrible situation because the plane had gotten hot pretty bad. One engine was out, and one engine was feathering, and we weren't making much headway. And I thought, boy, we'll be lucky to get back to base. But, you know, the Lord is with me, and that really helped.
Amen to that. And I think through the rest of your story, we're going to see that as well. I have to ask you, if you had a nearly fatal crash before you ever flew a mission, and then you got hit in the eyes and couldn't see after your first mission, were you a little hesitant to go on more missions after that?
You know, being an 18-year-old kid, you really are kind of fearless. You think, well, somebody's got to make it out of this, and I'm going to be the one. And you have that attitude that it's kind of a devil-may-care attitude, and you don't scare that easy.
And we're going to hear some more evidence to back that up when we come back with more of this special tribute to Dean Whitaker, who finished his journey on Earth last week at the age of 97. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.